We're back, and good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are. And welcome to the Aiken Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld webinar, 30 days post-election, reading the tea leaves on the U.S. renewables market. I am Ed Zelke. I'm chair of Aiken Gump's project finance practice and a longtime lawyer in the renewable energy industry. And I will serve as your host and moderator today. I'm very pleased to be joining you today with my panel, from the Robert Strauss Building in Washington, D.C. Before I introduce my panel, let me do a little housekeeping. First, all comments made here are off the record. This is intended to be a frank discussion for the benefit of our clients and friends, and as such, no reporters have been invited, and I remind you that the conditions to admission to this webinar include a requirement that nothing stated in this webinar can be publicly quoted or repeated. Second, although we are a law firm, nothing stated today shall be construed to be legal advice or be relied upon as legal advice. And finally, the final segment of this webinar will contain a question and answer period for the panel. Please use the chat box feature of the webinar screen to provide us with questions that we will try to get to in the last half an hour of the webinar. With that out of the way, let me introduce my panel. At Aiken Gump, we are not only fortunate to have one of the country's leading renewable energy practices, we also have one of the country's largest and most prestigious practices in the area of law and policy. We have been able to draw from both our renewables practice and our policy practice to put together a truly all-star panel representing both sides of the aisle for today's webinar. First, joining us today, we have Ed Pagano. Ed Pagano has agreed to step in for Senator Kay Hagan, who was advertised but is unable to attend due to an emergency this morning. Ed is a long-time fixture in the Democratic Party. He most recently served as the senior advisor to President Obama with respect to the legislative matters with the House and the Senate. Although Senator Hagan can't join us today, having Ed able to step in is a real pleasant surprise. Next, we have Senator John Sununu, a former U.S. Senator from New Hampshire. Senator Sununu is a Republican. Prior to serving in the U.S. Senate, Senator Sununu served three terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. Senator Sununu is an adjunct senior policy advisor to Aiken Gump. Next is Jeff McMillan, who is a partner in Aiken Gump's policy practice, specializing in federal tax issues. Jeff is also a Republican. Prior to joining Aiken Gump, Jeff served as staff director of the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Select Revenue Measures, also known as taxes. Jeff has been very involved in shaping renewable energy tax policy for a number of years, including significant involvement in the wind energy production tax credit and the investment tax credit for solar. We are also joined by Brian Pomper, who is a partner in Aiken Gump's policy practice, specializing in international trade issues. Brian is a Democrat. Prior to joining Aiken Gump, Brian served as trade counsel to the Senate Finance Committee on all aspects of international trade. Also joining us today is John Marciano, who is one of the country's leading lawyers in the field of renewable energy taxation. John is a partner in our project finance and renewable energy group, where he leads our renewable energy tax practice. As stated earlier, and for those of you just joining us, I am Ed Zelke. I chair Aiken Gump's project finance practice, and for most of my career have represented many of the leading developers and investors in the renewable energy industry in the U.S. Unlike the other members of the panel, who are based in Washington, D.C., I am based in the firm's Los Angeles office. So let's start the questioning with a bit of a view from Los Angeles. We'll start with Ed Pagano, our resident Democratic advisor. In Los Angeles prior to the election, I did not see a single Donald Trump bumper sticker or lawn sign. And listening to the national media, I, like many Californians, thought that Hillary was ahead by two touchdowns with 20 seconds to go. What happened?
Well, I would say that I live in Washington, D.C., so like you, I didn't see too many Trump signs. But I think in hindsight, this election is about the future. And nothing says the past like the Clintons. that it was a change election, and Hillary Clinton was not a change agent, and Donald Trump was. And give credit to Donald Trump for communicating that and for tapping into serial angst, particularly in the Rust Belt areas, about the future, about the American dream, and that a lot of folks are not seeing that American dream. They don't see it coming. Their children, their grandchildren have a better economic life, and that's a real change for America. And so I think he spoke to that forgotten middle class to a degree. And I think on Democrats, we have a bit of we spoke well to both coasts, but we didn't speak to the middle of the country as well as we should have. Now, I don't think it was, in hindsight, it's really not that close of an election based on the Electoral College, and that's what it's all about.
Okay. Senator Sununu, I heard one commentator after the election say that this election just showed just how out of touch the media and what he referred to as the educated elite on the East and West Coast are with the rest of America. As a Republican, what message do you take from this election?
Well, look, that is one of the messages. They were out of touch, not necessarily in a purely statistical way, because if you look at the national polls in the aggregate, they were always fairly close. But in the tone and tenor and their ability to identify what Ed described, that there was a big group of Americans really across the country, in almost every state, that felt that power brokers, elites, whether Washington-based or even in their own state capitals, weren't really speaking to them, speaking to the issues that were causing them anxiety through the year. And those issues have to do with economic security, with globalization, with a sense of stagnating or even declining wages. With a sense of declining American strength. Donald Trump spoke to those things. No one's surprised that the results in California or New York or Mississippi or Alaska or South Carolina, for that matter. The real surprise where the media and a lot of pollsters got it wrong were in those blue wall states, so to speak, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Those were states where both the way the campaigns were portrayed, Donald Trump's campaign and Hillary Clinton's campaign, was generally off the mark by the media, and the statistical findings of pollsters in those states were off the mark. That's where they really missed Trump's ability to connect with the classic Reagan Democrats, and I think that's what the election turned on, both nationally, both in the presidential race, and created that Electoral College victory that Ed described, but also in the down ballot races, our ability to, as Republicans, to hold Senate seats in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania is really what created the likely 52-48 margin for Republicans in the Senate going forward. And ultimately, that's going to be extremely important to Donald Trump when it comes both to a legislative agenda and getting his cabinet nominations approved.
Thank you. Let's drill down a bit on renewable energy under this administration. And staying with you, Senator Sununu, coming out of the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009, and under the policies of the Obama administration, the clean energy economy, as we're calling it, in general, and the renewable energy industry in particular, has seen unprecedented growth. Even with historical natural gas prices being low, the wind and solar energy now boasts 200,000 American jobs, many in manufacturing in the Rust Belt. Tens of millions of dollars each year are going to farmers and ranchers as land royalties, and significant construction employment for wind and solar projects exists. In fact, the solar industry reports that one out of every 70 jobs created since 2009 is in the solar industry. Because of this and the steadily decreasing cost of production, the renewable energy industry has done and should continue to do very well regardless of whether a Democrat or a Republican is in the White House. However, in addition to the jobs, the benefits of rural communities and domestic energy securities, one of the tailwinds of renewable energy has been and continues to be the environmental community, especially as it pertains to climate change. Renewable energy, as such then is viewed as one of the key weapons in the fight against climate change and could be viewed as a progressive agenda. In the president's recent recent appointments, including the climate denier, Marvin Ebel, to head the EPA's transition team, and yesterday's appointment of Scott Pruitt, an oil and gas attorney and anti-clean power plant activist, to head the U.S. EPA, there seems to be more than a subtle bend in favor of the U.S. oil industry. Despite its bipartisan support and its other benefits, should the renewable energy industry be worried?
Look, I think in Washington, it's hard to find an industry, whether it's renewable energies or any other industry, that don't at least have their ears turned up and are listening and watching very carefully. Because in all likelihood, this administration, as we move forward, is going to look a lot like the Trump campaign looked like over the past year. It's going to be somewhat impulsive. He's going to be bold. There are going to be a lot of unexpected events, whether you're looking at tax issues or regulatory issues across the board. So when it comes to renewables, I think we've got a few different forces working against one another. First, you have the clean energy story that you just described. Over the past few years, there's been bipartisan support for clean energy generally, for production and investment tax credits in the clean energy space in particular. There's a good economic story to tell that you alluded to. The investment cost per watt installed continues to decline. Operating costs continue to decline. So, clean energy production and performance continues to be at a cost per watt or per BTU generated closer and closer to traditional fossil fuels. So that's a good story. But running against that are concerns and anxieties, everything from the concern of crony capitalism, that some of these tax credits or tax benefits have flown disproportionately to favored companies, if not favored industries, the undercurrent of tax reform, which is going to open up a broad range of tax issues and obviously could expose the production tax credit or investment tax credit to change, and of course some backlash from or by people in states that traditionally create or generate and produce fossil fuel, backlash both on regulations that they think have been unfair to the oil and gas industry or to regulations like the Clean Power Plan that they think have been onerous. So these are things that are at odds with one another. And what we need to do and we'll try to do is sort of sift through the relative strength or weaknesses of each of these. I don't think there are going to be any significant changes to the ITC or production tax credit as currently crafted. I think even in a tax reform bill, that would be a heavy lift by the opponents. But I do think you're going to see a concerted effort at EPA and with the president's interior pick to try to, in their view, level the playing field, create more opportunities for oil and gas leasing on federal land and or offshore. I don't think the Clean Power Plan will ever go anywhere. I think it'll either be struck down in the courts or parts of it will be repealed by the agencies themselves. At the end of the day, I think there's going to be a continued push for clean energy and renewable energy to compete on the same economic footing as other forms of fossil energy production. I think there's a great potential there, but it just means that the renewable industry needs to continue to tell the economic story of investment, job creation, and increasingly competitive cost profile.
Thank you. Ed Pagano, I kind of want to ask you the same question. As part of the Obama White House, you were part of an administration that got very high marks from the environmental community for the efforts that Obama made and the efforts that you had working with the president in the Senate and the House. Is this going to be an anti-environment administration? And if so, will there be ripples that impact the clean tech economy?
Well, I certainly think there could be potential ripples. I don't see it as more anti-environment. I see it as anti-regulation. And I think this, as we've seen some of the appointments that the president-elect has made, and the general philosophy, I think it's going to be more of a free market philosophy. And at the agencies, I see a total change in the regulatory environment. Whether you disagree or agree, I think the Obama administration was pretty muscular in the sense of using agencies to advance agenda, to advance with other pro-growth policies through regulations. And I think we go to the opposite from the Trump administration. So I think, as I agree with Senator Sununu, things like the clean power plant regulations and other things will either the courts or new appointments within the administration will kind of quickly look at regulations and withdraw them, suspend them, change them, amend them. So it's really going to be an anti-regulation first 100 days, I can see very quickly, and throughout the 4 years of the Trump administration.
Thank you.
At least 4 years.
Let's switch now for a second to some specifics. Jeff McMillan, you were involved in the recent long-term extension of the long-term being 4 years, which is a long-term for the extension of the wind production tax credit and the solar investment tax credit. This long-term extension occurred in a bipartisan way at the end of 2015. And the industry had been arguing for years, going back to the first expiration of the PTC in the end of 1999, that the industry needed a longer-term tax credit so that it could invest in R&D and invest in things like foundries in the U.S. to develop an even more efficient clean energy fleet of wind projects and solar projects. Their wish was finally granted, I think, to some degree at the end of 2015, but it came at a cost of a phase down of the production tax credit and the investment tax credit. Do you see that tax credit and the phase down structure as vulnerable under this administration?
I don't know that I would say vulnerable, but there's always a risk with a change in the administration. There was a compromise at the end of 2015. Both the PTC and the ITC were extended over a four-year period for 5 years. And in exchange for that, the Republicans were able to add to the appropriations bill a repeal of the ban on oil exports. So there was a give and take there by both sides of the Capitol and both sides of the aisle. There's always a risk. I think the president-elect is a different kind of risk that we haven't quite seen before, so it remains to be seen. That said, there were not a whole lot of industries that approached Congress and said, here is our tax benefit, and we propose that if you extend it for a period of time, that we will phase out. And in the PTC's case, it phases out to zero. The ITC goes to 10%. I would like to think that compromise survives. We're 17, 18, and 19 are left, so 80, 60, and 40 on the PTC. I would like to think that compromise that was worked out will be there. But again, there's a risk. I don't think it's a high risk, but it's something that the industry should be paying attention to. And someone said earlier that they need to keep their ears to the ground and work the issue. I don't think you always should be active and not reactive.
John Marciano, kind of the same question. You as a the tax practitioner are in the weeds on these tax credits every day. Are clients you're working with in this space generally concerned about a repeal of the tax benefits?
No, we're not to be too bullish on it, but people are worried about uncertainty for sure. But there's really a fairly small degree of worry about the credits going away outright ahead of schedule. The larger concern right now seems to be what will tax reform entail if it happens and how likely is that to occur?
We'll get to that in a minute, I promise. But before going there, let me ask Senator Sununu. It sounds like, although nothing going to be taken for granted, and I assume that both industry groups in the solar and wind and otherwise will reach out to their friends on both sides of the aisle to make sure that the tax credits stay in place, at least as currently existing. Do you see much of a risk, given the bipartisan support for wind and solar, do you see much of a risk of an outright repeal of the existing tax credits?
No. I think the likelihood of a repeal of the current framework is very low. I think the odds that they phase out in 2019, as they're currently scheduled to do, is significant. You know, maybe 50-50, maybe a little bit less than 50-50, but it's a real possibility. But I think the third option is that they're extended as part of a tax reform deal. And I think it's important for people to understand, one, that there absolutely will be an effort in both the House and the Senate to pass tax reform legislation relatively early in 2017. Second, that they'll have the opportunity to do it under a reconciliation rule that only requires 51 votes in the Senate, technically 50 votes plus the vice president to break the tie from the Republican perspective. And third, that the effort will be focused on corporate taxes, not individual taxes. And that's simply because that's where the emphasis has been, that's where the opportunity is to affect real improvements in economic growth and productivity, frankly, the political risks are lower on the corporate side than the individual side, where you have to start talking about things like mortgage interest and charitable deductions.
Right.
So I think it's highly likely that we'll see tax reform effort, and the real question in my mind is whether that is done exclusively under a 51 vote reconciliation rule, or whether the Senate is able to grow the vote to get 60 votes in the Senate, more bipartisan bill. That's what Orrin Hatch would like to do as chairman of the Finance Committee. But the question is, how do you grow that vote? An agreement to extend renewable tax credits, I think, would be something of real interest to Democrats. And it may be a way that you grow the vote and make the bill a little bit more bipartisan. So that's where I think the real question will be for the renewable industry within the tax reform legislation.
Interesting. Well, we're going to get to tax reform in a minute. Just before going there, though, I do want to spend a minute with Brian Pomper, our trade expert, who's inside of the Senate for a number of years. Brian, the environment, frankly, didn't get a lot of talk in this election cycle, but trade did. And trade was in every speech and in every debate, trade was front and center. What impact do you see, you know, the existing trade policies and possible changes having on the wind and solar area? Solar, obviously, is probably the panels are constructed more outside of the country than is wind. Wind probably is well over 50% in terms of domestic production. But how do you see the trade issues impacting this industry?
Yeah, thanks, Ed. I think it was a surprise to a lot of trade observers that trade was as big of an issue as it was in this last campaign. I think it's undeniable that it was. I do think, you read in the paper how Donald Trump is moderating or walking back from many of some of the more aggressive statements he may have made during the campaign. But trade is one area where I think actually he's really going to do a lot of the things that he talked about. I think he is aggressively going to pursue a different course than many previous administrations have taken. So how does that impact the industry specifically? Well, I think in a couple different ways. There will be a renewed focus on enforcement, forcing trade obligations around the world. I know, obviously, that the industry has dealt a lot with the solar panel cases, the anti-dumping countervailing duty cases coming out of China, and now I guess Taiwan as well. I would say in terms of anti-dumping countervailing duty cases, every administration is pretty aggressive on those. So I don't think you'll see a big change in terms of how actually those cases, once filed, will be run. They're always very aggressive, trying to block as many imports as they can, frankly. One area that you may see differently, the U.S. government actually has the power to self-initiate these anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases. That hasn't been done in decades, I think not since the Reagan administration. So it's conceivable, and there's been talk about how a Trump administration could actually self-initiate on certain products. No discussion of specific products, but it wouldn't surprise me if something in the renewable energies area wouldn't be part of that. So more enforcement. The other thing I'd say is the Trump team talks a lot, or Trump himself talks a lot about his policy on trade will be hire American, buy American. And certainly with respect to renewable energy, when you've got these big projects, if you get any federal money, you could see how his government would essentially require potentially the use of domestically produced products. That it gets a little tricky. There are international rules on how government procurement works. But for the renewable energy space, where you get a lot of these solar panels, China, Taiwan, I think Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, none of those countries are party to this international agreement. So actually, the administration could require domestic use of those panels made in the United States, and those countries couldn't complain about it. So I think, just to sum up quickly, you'd expect a lot more aggressive enforcement. I do think there is a history, obviously, of trade enforcement in the alternative energy space, not even just with solar panels, but I know there's an existing order on wind turbines from Vietnam. So I would expect to see more, frankly. I think that the domestic producers are going to see their window of opportunity, and I would expect them to try to take it.
Thank you. Let's switch back to tax reform. That is going to be a significant discussion, as Senator Sununu alluded. Jeff McMillan, what does tax reform look like? What's on the table, and what will be at least asked for initially?
So I think, and Senator Sununu alluded to this, that on the Senate side, I think there's going to be parallel tracks, one in the Senate and one in the House, and at some point in time they merge. On the Senate side, I think Mr. McConnell and Mr. Hatcher are institutionalists and will at least want to make a run at a 60-vote bill through regular order, and they'll make an effort to do so. Assuming that the Republicans win Louisiana, they'll have 52 Republican senators next year. In order to get 60 votes, my guess is, obviously you need a minimum of 8, my guess is you probably need closer to a dozen Democrats to jump on board to get to 60. I think, you know, sometimes we joke that the number after 59 is not 60, it's 62 or 63.
Could you lose Republicans as you add Democrats?
Exactly right, and nobody wants to be the 60th vote unless there's a 61 right behind them, Senator Sununu. Is that better?
No, it's very good. Well, no. In this case, no one in the minority wants to be that 60th vote, but if there are 62 or 63, then there's safety or comfort in numbers.
But if you're going regular order, you're getting 60 or more votes, it's a compromise bill. So my guess is that, you know, watching what the Republicans and Democrats have been doing on the Finance Committee, Chairman Hatch, now Minority Leader Schumer, Rob Portman, and others, I think that you've got that bill looks like a change of the current system. Probably at the margins, there'll be an international change that I think moving from a worldwide system to a territorial system. But that bill might look a lot at a structural level, close to what Chairman Camp, former Ways and Means Committee member, Chairman, put out a couple of years ago.
Which is what?
It's a move. It's lower rates. It moves from a worldwide system to a territorial system, but it still keeps a lot of the anti-abuse rules in the international system that are there. it's base broadening, so you lose a lot of things in order to get 10 points. It was revenue neutral. It was distributionally neutral. Very difficult to do, but I think that's what a compromise bill looks like. Meanwhile, in the House, I think that you'll see they will use reconciliation. Reconciliation means a couple of things. One, you only need 51 votes in the Senate, so that means that the Republicans could do it on their own, presumably. It's still got to be pretty close. You can only lose two votes, so you'd have to make sure that you know where the center members are, and you'd have to figure out where the members on the further on the right are. It could be a little game of whack-a-mole. If you keep two in the center, do you lose two on the right? It'll be very difficult for Chairman Hatch and Mr. McConnell to thread that needle. But the starting point for the House bill and reconciliation instructions is the blueprint that Speaker Ryan and Chairman Brady put out in June. It is a change in the system. It is more of a consumption-based tax. It's almost a VAT light. The biggest difference meaning they do allow deductions for domestic wages. The rate would go down much further, 20%. I think Chairman Camp got it at 25%. It would also go to a territorial system, but instead of anti-abuse rules, they would implement a border adjustable system. Border adustable is kind of the 30,000 foot way to see it is their exports would be exempted from tax, and imports, be they goods, services, or intellectual property, would have a tax put on them as they come into the United States. It's kind of the idea is this will take tax out of the question, and when companies decide where they're going to put their next physical plant or where they're going to add jobs, you take tax out of the question. Perhaps that brings people into the United States on the manufacturing or other sides, and obviously a low 20% rate. The blueprint allows expensing, so complete write-off of capital expenditures in the first year. That's 1A. I think 1B is therefore an elimination of interest deductibility. I think sometimes people think those are two separate provisions. I believe that they are one provision, that if you have expensing, you need elimination of interest deductibility, which will be interesting to see how that works. But I think that they can move this relatively quickly in the House. Meanwhile, the Senate's working on a different type of bill. But I do think for the Senate, as they are working a compromise, and it's going to be difficult to get to 60 if at any point in time they think it becomes too expensive, and I don't mean dollar expensive, I mean expensive to Republican ideals, or if the Democrats just aren't willing to play and get anywhere near 60, then Chairman Hatch and Mr. McConnell, Leader McConnell, have a tool, which is, hey guys, either we can work on this bill where you participate, or we can go reconciliation ourselves, and we can do it by ourselves.
Ed Pagano, if you can answer this or ask Senator Cennino. There's been a lot of talk about the 60-vote rule and reconciliation. And for those on the webinar who are not part of the Washington Inside Baseball, what does that mean in a practical sense? What are these rules of the game, if you would, that we're operating under that are going to impact these twists and turns?
Sure. So there are two different bodies. We have the House of Representatives, which operates on a pure majority vote. There are a majority of more than 30 Republicans over Democrats in the House. So in essence, Republicans will control the House, and Democrats have very little input on legislation. It's a majority body. It was a super majority body in the Senate. That, therefore, to pass anything, general rule, any major legislation requires 60 votes. We anticipate that the Senate will be a breakdown of 52 Republicans, 48 Democrats next year. Do a simple math. If all Republicans are online on a bill, we require 8 Democrats to support to get to 60. Not all Republicans will be aligned on a bill. That's pretty unusual. So as Jeff alluded to, it could be requiring 10 or 12 Democrats to get to the magic number of 60. There's special provisions called budget reconciliation, and the details will put you to sleep. So I won't go through the details. Mind-numbing. Bottom line is, and there are parliamentarians that kind of do this for a living, but bottom line, and Senator Sununu actually knows these rules very well, the bottom line is that if it has a budget impact, those budget impacts measured in a 10-year window, then you can use the budget reconciliation rules. That can be used, in, so therefore, for tax cuts, because tax rates do affect the budget, but for 10 years. If you remember, a couple years ago, we had a fiscal cliff, right? How stupid is Congress? Well, Congress is so stupid that we passed the budget, the Bush tax cuts in 2001 on budget reconciliation rule. That was a 10-year window. That's why the tax cuts expired. That's why we had this cliff that made no sense, and that's why we almost, you know, had a back and forth in Congress with the president, and then eventually we didn't jump over the cliff and changed our tax code. President Obama strongly advocated for an increase in the upper rates, upper income rates, and that was accomplished. So that's why we're having this debate about, is it 51 votes budget reconciliation? Is it 60 votes if it's not a budget reconciliation? And certain things can be done. We anticipate the repeal of the Affordable Care Act will mostly be done on budget reconciliation process. So it's a 51 vote process. And I think that will happen relatively quickly in the new Congress. What we replace with is unclear, but so that's what we're doing with the 60 vote special in the Senate. Pure majority vote in the House. So, fortunately, unfortunately, House Democrats are semi irrelevant in the House, but Senate Democrats are important under the filibuster rule.
Thank you. Senator Sununu, I know as an MIT grad, you probably understand this stuff better than most of us, but for the plain and kind of the, based on what Ed Pagano just said, if it deals with revenue or expenses, is it subject to reconciliation? Is that the general rule, or is there more to it than this?
No. Look, that's a pretty accurate way of looking at it. The way this gets done is the House and Senate pass a budget resolution that will have a reconciliation instruction in it, and that reconciliation instruction could be $1 billion, and they direct the tax writing committees to raise or save, to enact policy that changes revenue collection by some number, say $1 billion. And as long as the policies that they enact directly affect the collection of revenues, it will be protected under that 51 vote threshold. That's the way that it happens. And they will do a budget resolution in January that will have a reconciliation instruction for Obamacare, for dealing with Obamacare on the spending side and on the tax side. And then another resolution will be passed, likely in late March or April, that will have the reconciliation number for broad tax reform. There are a couple of the other things that I think people want to bear in mind as they watch this process unfold. Couple other factors that will be in play that are a little bit different than tax reform debates in past years. One, from a partisan or bipartisan perspective, the partners, the Democratic ranking members on the House Ways and Means Committee will be Rich Neal from Massachusetts. He's a very pragmatic legislator. He's been on the Ways and Means Committee for a long time. He has terrific relationships across the aisle, a good working relationship with the chairman, Kevin Brady, who's from Texas. So there's a partnership there, or a potential partnership there, that I would argue didn't necessarily exist in the past in the House. And on the Senate side, the ranking Democrat is Senator Ron Wyden, someone who has worked on and talked about tax reform for a long time. This doesn't guarantee bipartisanship, but I think it puts in the room some strong partners on both sides of the table and people who are fairly pragmatic and I think have a genuine interest in trying to find common ground. Second political factor is that in the Senate, you're going to have some significant competitive races for Democrats coming up in 2018 in states like Michigan and Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and Montana as well. Interestingly, these are states that are care about manufacturing. And there's a strong potential for a tax reform bill to be effectively pro-manufacturing. Jeff talked about expensing. This is something that's very attractive to capital-intensive manufacturing industries. So at the end of the day, you have things like a territorial system or a border-adjustable system that has expensing that makes it a pro-manufacturing bill, the potential to bring the renewable tax credits into the tax reform debate to broaden the vote and win Democrats. I think you're likely to have a repeal, a change of the tax regime for carried interest, which would be attractive to Democrats. And finally, the prospect of dealing with repatriation of offshore cash, bringing it back for some sort of a modest but meaningful toll that would raise revenues on a one-time basis, but still raise significant revenues. And there's always been discussion about using a portion of those revenues from repatriation for infrastructure, something that's also very attractive to Democrats and attractive to many Republicans as well. But those are factors that I could see potentially growing the vote and enabling the Senate to do a bill with 62 or 63 votes that would still be attractive in the House and be able to be signed by the president, a bill that would be permanent and not subject to this 10-year window.
I would just add on that I think Senator Sununu is certainly spot on about the politics that you do have now. 25, the next cycle, 2018, 25 Democratic senators up for re-election. 10 of those 25 are from what I call Trump states, states where Donald Trump won, particularly those Rust Belt states and some other more conservative states. So those senators are going to be very mindful about do they really want to oppose or filibuster a tax reform bill, particularly if it's a pro-manufacturing bill. Senator Schumer is very smart politically, and he is aware of that. His job as the minority leader now will be to protect that class of 2018 and those senators. So he'll be, I think, negotiating in good faith. Whether they can get there to 60 votes or not is, the question for the next year. But there is the political dynamic a little bit different coming up because of those Democratic senators up for re-election in the Trump states.
I understand the reason we're spending a lot of time on this in this webinar is that the success of the renewable energy industry in the U.S. has been built on the backs, in many cases, of not just the improving technology and the state renewable portfolio standards, but it's been a tax credit-driven system, that the federal government will give a tax credit if you can improve the technology enough and eventually hopefully become cost competitive without the tax credit. That's kind of the theory, and it's worked pretty well. We've moved from very expensive wind turbines and very inefficient wind turbines in 1981 to 82 to these incredibly efficient machines in 2016. The policy has worked, I think, by most standards. But it is still an important part of how we finance and build the renewable industry, and John Marciano can attest to this. If we change the tax rate from 35 to 20, it is going to have a significant effect, short term, maybe less intermediate term, depending on when the tax credit tax rate change were to occur. If it happens on Tuesday, it has one effect. If it happens 5 years from now, it has a different effect. Jeff McMillan, kind of reading the tea leaves. Kind of two questions here, and I probably ask the same of Ed Pagano and Senator Sununu. Is this tax reform likely to be a nibble, or are we going to? Is there going to be an effort to try to swallow the whole cheese by make substantial changes or nothing all at once? And second, under one scenario or another, do you see this taking a long time, or is this something that's going to happen in the next 6 to 8 months?
So I don't, given the elections and given the Republicans holding the House, Senate, and the administration, I don't think anybody right here and right now is interested in nibbling. Tax reform happens. As the last time it happened was 30 years ago in 1986. The use of reconciliation and the possibility that you could have tax reform that sunsets in 10 years tells you that they see this as a significant opportunity, and they are going to try to get comprehensive tax reform. I do think that they'll get budget reconciliation instructions out. April could slip into May. It'll take time. I think we'll know maybe as soon as the August recess. Maybe it slips into the fall. Are we going to get tax reform? And if so, how much are we going to get? I think it's going to be a big chunk. If it's not comprehensive, at least corporate or business income could be taken care of. That comes with its own pitfalls. If it lasts too long into 2018, it becomes more and more difficult to get as you approach the next election. I'm not going to wager on if tax reform is going to happen, but the chances of it happening now are much greater than they were a month ago. And I think you've got strong leaders and at the top of the Republican Party, and Speaker Ryan, who's a former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and Mr. McConnell. They've got potentially willful partners and Mr. Schumer and Mr. Wyden and Mr. Neal, as John stated. But it's hard.
Willful and cooperative versus obstruction. Is that kind of willful?
Well, we'll see. I think it may be willful for a piece of time, and then we'll see how it goes. It's hard. So I don't think tax reform is a done deal. They're going to have to work hard and have to work smart, and they're going to have a limited window of opportunity because if it goes too far, it gets more difficult as we approach 2018 election.
It sounds simplistic, but one of the things that's different is there's no one on either side of the aisle with any important role saying we shouldn't be doing tax reform. And that's meaningful. I think the key period will be between April 1st and July 30th before they go out on recess to see how much work and progress they can make. And frankly, I think both chambers need to either have passed versions of tax reform or have set up a bill to be passed shortly after they return from recess in order for there to be a good likelihood to get this done. But when they break on July 30th, people in and around Washington will have a strong indication as to whether or not it's going to get done. You'll be able to see the progress made in committees, see the political obstacles, see how engaged the Trump administration is, and know with some certainty whether or not it's going to happen in the fall.
And I would just add the one wild card to me is
Ed Pagano, brother.
Is President Trump. I don't know how President Trump's going to govern, okay? I really don't. And is he the art of the deal? Is he the guy that calls up Chuck Schumer and brings in Mitch McConnell and Speaker Ryan in the Oval Office and says, here's what we're going to do, or here's, I'm locking the door until we get a deal. Is he a hands-off guy and lets Congress fight it out? I don't know how that's going to play out, but I think that could be, instrumental in how to have a success or not in the first year of his administration.
Anything is possible, but if the past tax reform battles are any indication, it's highly unlikely that President Trump will be able to tweet his way to success. I mean, this has to be done through some really, really tough negotiation, both at the House and Senate level, but also with engagement from the White House.
I do want to talk a little bit about border adjustability with in a moment. But before getting there, I can't imagine that if you have something like border adjustability as part of an overall tax plan where, in essence, it's going to make imported goods more expensive, that the Republican senators from states like Arkansas, where Walmart is based, and some others are simply going to say, that's okay. And so I guess the question is, do we really have enough Republicans to pass meaningful or comprehensive tax reform on reconciliation?
I think the border adjustability or territorial nature of the system still has a lot of details to be worked out, and I would defer to Jeff McMillan on this, but I think it can be done in a way that survives a WTO challenge, done in a way which I think comes back to the phrase I used, it being a pro-manufacturing a structure. You can have a territorial system that's pro-manufacturing that doesn't necessarily run afoul of the WTO structure. So it really does depend on how it's put together, and if you end up with an issue, say the retailers are opposing the legislation, that's not a Republican problem or a Democrat problem, and I still think that doesn't preclude you from winning a lot of Democrat votes if the other attributes we talked about earlier, pro-manufacturing, dealing with renewables, dealing with carried interest, repatriation, if those elements are in there, the fact that one particular industry isn't as happy as they might be isn't necessarily an obstacle. I don't know if Jeff McMillan wants to weigh in on the different ways of dealing with the territorial system and whether or not it will be easy or difficult to work around WTO restrictions.
So I'm gonna start kind of the discussion on border adjustability, but I think Brian Pomper.
I want to hear Brian Pomper's idea whether we're about to enter a new trade war. But
yeah, exactly. So under the WTO rules, border adjustability is allowed if the tax system which employs border adjustability is an indirect tax. Classic example of an indirect tax is a VAT. Border adjustability is not allowed when you have a direct tax, an income tax being the prime example of a direct tax. The blueprint looks a lot like a VAT, but for the domestic deduction for wages. And then the question there does that tilt the needle back closer to an income tax? Is it closer to a VAT? Obviously, Ways and Means is very aware of what the tests are. What are the other things that make it look like an indirect tax? Expensing. Elimination of interest deductibility. So there are things that are weighed to try to make it look more like a VAT, more like an indirect tax. And they're very aware of that. And that is the tightrope that they're going to have to walk as we're going to go down this road. And then ultimately, if this were to pass with border adjustability, it would be a case before the WTO, I would surmise.
Brian Pomper, where do you see that shaking out? Are we going to be attacked by our friends and neighbors as not being on the up and up on trade going forward here?
Well, if you look at the mechanism of border adjustability, essentially people talk about it as adding like a 20% tariff to everything coming in. That's how it would work. It's not actually how it would feel. Maybe
right.
It's not actually how it works. So I'd be surprised if our trading partners didn't challenge it. And in the trade community, and I should add, I mean, there are like the retailers and others, industry sectors who are just beside themselves at the idea of border adjustability. So I imagine they would probably be encouraging such a challenge. I would say it this way, and of course, we don't have a border adjustability text yet. As John said, it could maybe be drafted in a way. I think there's a lot of skepticism in the trade world that you can, and I think there's a real concern that there is true WTO jeopardy in going down this road. So I would expect us to be challenged, and we could lose. I mean, we have experience losing big tax cases before the World Trade Organization when we did the Foreign Sales Corporation extraterritorial.
Brian, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So let's assume we pass a border adjustable tax and cases brought against it. What is a potential time period? Is that a 2 to 3 year process? Is it a 10 year process?
It's a more of a 2 to 3 year type, or 2 to 4 years maybe, I'd say. It depends. And right now the system at the WTO, the dispute settlement system, is a little bit backed up. So maybe a little longer, but it could happen in the first term of a Trump presidency. Let's put it that way. Certainly at the they call it the panel stage. There's an appeal as well, but you could easily see a decision at the panel stage. It would, by all accounts, it would be possibly the largest case
ever before the World Trade Organization to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And the concern the trade community has is if we are to lose such a case, it really does call into question the entire world trading system, because I could foresee a circumstance where there would be calls to withdraw from the World Trade Organization rather than change our entire tax structure that we've just gone through a bruising battle to do. So this is a rocky road, truly. But certainly, as John said, I think one that everybody thinks we need to travel down and try to figure out all these questions.
Do you think it would overturn, in effect, feel like overturning NAFTA and the relationships we have with our European trading partners? Is everyone going to have now? Is going to be a level playing field where everyone gets treated as our 20% foe?
Yeah. So, I mean, with respect to NAFTA, and I should have said this earlier, to the extent NAFTA is important to people on the phone, that's being renegotiated. That's going to happen. I don't think Trump is going to tear it up and throw it out, but they are going to renegotiate it. And so if there are provisions in there that are important to you that you use, you should be thinking about that, because they're everything is up for grabs. I mean, the WTO is the surround sound of the trading system. It's virtually every country in the world is a member of the World Trade Organization. It's the baseline rules that govern international trade. The idea, and of course, it was largely a creation of the United States. So the concept of the United States pulling out of the WTO is a really frightening one from the standpoint of those in the trade community. And I'm not saying that that's what would necessarily happen, but if you do lose a major case like this, where the WTO says actually your border adjustability provisions are contra to your WTO agreements, you have to pay hundreds of billions of dollars in compensation to your trading partners. I don't see how you don't at least contemplate the idea of pulling out of the World Trade Organization. What I do hear is, if we do get to that point, that maybe there would be a renewed effort on the part of the United States to renegotiate the terms of the World Trade Organization, and maybe that's where this would go, in order to allow a tax that looks like the border adjustability, which is a little bit of a hybrid between direct and indirect, to be copacetic underneath the WTO rules. That's maybe the most likely outcome, but it would be really turbulent and disruptive.
Ed Pagano, we started the conversation. I do want to get these questions right after this, and we have several. Given the messages in this election, does the American public are they really ready to start a trade war? I mean, that has to be the logical conclusion from what Brian Pomper just said.
Well, I would say the voters weren't logical in this election, from my perspective.
Spoken like a true Democrat.
Spoken like a Democrat. Exactly. Yeah. I certainly think, and I actually think there is a bipartisan sense that the trade, free trade, has not delivered the economic benefits to the middle class that were promised, certainly in NAFTA and other trade agreements. So, and that was the message, I think, in this election. One of the reasons why Bernie Sanders did so well in the primary, certainly Donald Trump in the primary and the general. So, but I don't think any voters made the conclusion that they want or don't want a trade war. And I don't think they made that jump. But they certainly made the jump that these free trade agreements are not working for me. I'm not working for my fellow working class folks, and something needs to change.
Thank you, Ed. We have about 28 minutes left in the webinar, and this is the point at which we will move to audience questions. And we've received a number already, but if you have an audience question, please use the chat box on your webinar screen and forward the questions to us, and we will try to get as many of them answered as we can by our panel. The first question comes to John Marciano. John, what will the impact be if we see a reduction of corporate income taxes from 35% to, say, 20 or 25%? What impact will that have on the tax equity market, in particular for wind under the production tax credit?
I think the first thing to think about is, what has the effect been of even the prospect of that? Uncertainty is sort of the opponent of investment and getting deals done. So we're already seeing some impact. I think everyone, most of the investors that are coming into the market are, or that are already playing in the market, think the big risk for tax equity deals, for renewable projects in terms of the financing structures, is a lower tax rate. What does that mean? Well, that means that depreciation, if potentially, has a lower value. And so if you add tax credits to depreciation, the government pays indirectly about 50% of the project cost. So you might lose some degree of that by having a lower tax rate in the upfront period when you're claiming depreciation. But on the back end, so you claim depreciation over 5 or 6 years, you have a project that has a 35-year life. You have a much longer period of time where there's a lower tax burden. It actually could work out to the benefit of people. And so there are a number of almost everyone's doing the math right now trying to figure out, in my deal, will I actually come out ahead if the rates go down? And at what point does the law have to change for it to be a negative for me? So you know, we're seeing deals affected in this way because the investors will say, okay, well, I'm going to assume that in, let's say, January 1, 2018, the rate goes from 35% to 15%, because that's one of the rates that people have been talking about. And they sort of look at the worst-case scenario, not the expected, but the worst case. And so they say, okay, well, if it's 15% starting January 1, 2018, how much will I put in? And this is most important for the construction lenders, because the construction lenders put their money out, and then they wait for the tax equity to come in and pay them down. And if the tax equity is going to put in less than expected, there has to be some degree of overage that the construction lenders are taking into account. So I think the real effect right now is probably going to be a bit of a sizing down on construction lending. I don't think it's going to mean that it won't happen, but it will be that a slightly more conservative sizing arrangement.
Okay, so the factors are, it sounds like if you have a typical PTC tax equity structure where the tax equity investor is going to receive the benefits of the production tax credit for 10 years, is going to receive some depreciation losses, and is going to receive cash. Well, the depreciation losses, if the tax change happens in the first 5 years, would be impacted. Certainly the cash piece is going to be benefited because they will have a lower tax rate on the cash and then going forward.
So it really
depends on how much of a tax rate cut and when it occurs in the life cycle of a project. Is that
Yeah, fair? That's exactly right. And one of the things to think about is if there's a lower rate, will we have as many people that are interested in coming in as investors predominantly for tax goodies? The answer to that might be no, or it might be that we have a slightly smaller pool. I think the big banks will be as interested. Some of the newer investors, that this is not in their wheelhouse to do tax investing. They are just sort of coming in now after seeing people do tax equity deals for 10, 12 years and saying, me too. They may pull back just ever so slightly as they sort of try and assess what their tax liabilities will be going forward. It might mean that we do more investment credit deals, more deals with bonus depreciation, so the goodies are front-loaded. And so there's not as much of a worry about the law changing.
Jeff McMillan, there is some talk about the infrastructure investment possibly being funded itself through some sort of a tax credit arrangement. But in the discussion, notwithstanding Senator Sununu's statement that the possibility of hanging on to tax credits might incent some Democrats to join the party on tax reform, which I think would be a masterstroke and could continue a number of the positives that tax credits have provided in a number of industries, I think, going forward. But does the blueprint have a complete elimination of tax credits? If the blueprint went through the House blueprint, do you know if it just goes to a flat 15% and everything is disappears?
So the blueprint goes to 20. One tax credit remains in the blueprint, and it's the research expenditure, or otherwise known as the research, the R&D tax credit remains. There's been some discussion, is low-income housing tax credit. The blueprint is silent, but there's been some conversations later that might survive. But basically, all of the credits go away in the blueprint. Obviously, thing just because the blueprint says it, so that doesn't mean the blueprint's going to get passed as is.
There's likely going to be a transitional rule, right?
I would assume that there's going to be a transitional rule. As we stated at the beginning of this, I think the transition rule that the PTC and the ITC struck last year, I would think sticks in tax reform. But again, that's something that people will have to work on. On the repatriation piece, there's a lot of discussion about all of the trapped cash because of the worldwide system that's outside the U.S. There's been a lot of discussion on maybe perhaps more on Democratic side than Republican side on infrastructure. Obviously, President-elect Trump has talked a lot about infrastructure. So I do think that there's an opportunity for repatriation, and Chairman Brady's kind of tamped this down a bit. But it's been out in the discussion for so long, there is an opportunity, perhaps, it was in the camp bill a couple of years ago, is that repatriation dollars used from repatriation would go towards infrastructure. The repatriation proposal that Mr. Camp put out would have a bifurcated rate, one rate, a lower rate, 3.5%, for earnings that have been reinvested abroad, so-called bricks and mortar, and a higher rate, 8.75%, if I'm not mistaken, on cash or cash-like holdings. Mr. Trump has suggested a 10% for both of those. We'll see how that rates. The Camp bill raised about 125 on its own, and then with other effects with other provisions in the Camp bill, it raised another 40, so about $165 billion. Two more years of money being trapped outside, that number probably goes up. You know, at some point in time, I wonder, does that number get too high? And some Republicans on the right see this as, hey, wait a minute, that's taxing and spending. Maybe this is not what we're looking for here. But I do think if we get tax reform, there's a good chance for repatriation. I think there's a good chance that some of that goes towards infrastructure. The idea that there's $1 trillion of infrastructure that can be paid for within the tax code, I think, is a bit high. And then the other question I saw on the board is, what is infrastructure? As when I was a staffer, we did energy bills. I can't tell you the number of meetings that I had where everything was energy, even if it remotely one time had an E in it. It was energy related, and I think you'll see that with infrastructure as well. And I think the question here says, can we do transmission? Is that part of infrastructure? I don't know why it couldn't be.
I think the numbers that that Jeff describes are certainly pretty accurate. Like if you deal with repatriation, I think $200 billion in revenues in the short term. Raise from a repatriation, a tax of roughly 10%, as was suggested, very realistic. I don't think you spend all of that. You have the opportunity to use half of that, say, $100 billion, to pay for the tax reform, so to speak, which wins you votes on the right. Conservatives that want a stronger and more economically effective tax reform bill, but you have $100 billion on the infrastructure side. I think that wins votes on the Democratic side, but it also gives you the opportunity to leverage it a little bit. I don't think you're going to get to whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump's $1 trillion in infrastructure, but if it is structured as a tax credit, 25% infrastructure investment tax credit. You can leverage that $100 billion into $400 billion of investment. And given the interest in this administration and in their campaign in energy infrastructure, pipelines, transmission, I think it's highly likely that those could be a part of the mix in addition to, roads and bridges, especially if it's done through a tax credit, because we have a highway bill already that's committing hundreds of billions to roads and bridges, but the idea of something that more directly affects the domestic infrastructure for productivity, for energy production, energy distribution, I think is very, very attractive, and again, could be attractive to members on both sides of the aisle.
Good, thank you. That's encouraging, certainly for the renewable energy industry. Staying with you, Senator Sununu, another question here. What would be the path, if you would, to reinstituting or sustaining the production tax credit and investment tax credit in a tax reform bill? You certainly have the issue of the possibility of some of the goods that are currently being used to build renewable energy projects becoming more expensive if there is a border adjustability, if you would. And we saw certainly when I sat on the board of directors of AWEA from 2002 to 2013, we saw with a fairly stable production tax credit the number of the manufacturing percentage of wind projects move from 10% U.S. to over 50%. So you had, but it takes time to build new factories and the like to move domestic manufacturing domestic, if you would, from overseas. Could you see an extension beyond 2019 of the PTC and ITC as part of this process?
Well, as I indicated earlier, I think it's possible. I think it would really only happen or is most likely to happen as part of a negotiation to broaden the vote and to win votes of Democrats in particular, but also there are a number of Republicans for whom that would be attractive. But again, the provision would have to bring with it votes. It wouldn't be done, it wouldn't just happen out of thin air or because the chairman of the committees think this is a great idea. It would happen because they really feel it's the key to getting the vote base necessary for passage. And look, in terms of how proponents make the argument, you're on the right path. It's about showing the past success of these provisions in driving domestic manufacturing, domestic content, job creation, and ultimately driving better performance metrics in terms of the cost of installation, cost of operation, and driving the renewable industry toward parity with traditional fossil fuels, oil and natural gas in particular. If you can tell that story, tell it effectively, tell it clearly, that's obviously going to help when the time comes in the negotiation to consider whether or not there should be any extension of the credits.
Thank you. John Marciano, I'm going to share this next question with you. There is a, as we know, in the both the solar and the wind industry, the tax credits are available if you start construction at their current rates, and they phase down. But for 2016, if you start construction in 2016, the current levels of tax benefits and tax credits will be available to you as long as you complete within the deadline. So folks are working very hard to start construction on a number of projects on both the wind and the solar front under an IRS guidance safe harbor of spending at least 5% of the project costs or commencement of physical construction, either on-site or off-site. One of the things I have seen in the last, since the election, is more and more of our clients and others in the industry seem to be leaning a bit more towards physical start of construction because it's less expensive than the 5% down payment. The uncertainty has caused folks to keep their money in their wallet a little longer than they don't have to. There's another way of investing in a project. They are certainly using physical construction more than I guess I would have expected they would have. The second part of the question then is what is the likelihood that the IRS guidance is going to be changed? So to the extent that I've invested my 5% safe harbor this or started my construction, am I going to be surprised in March when the IRS decides that it doesn't work anymore? Is that a high probability, low probability? How would you handicap that?
I think it's a low probability. The guidance that we've got five different pieces of IRS guidance that tell us what it means to start construction of a wind farm. We don't have anything yet on solar. You know, what does it mean to start construction for the investment credit for solar? That one is supposed to come out relatively soon. We're hoping by the end of the year. The issue, though, is the statute, the legislation that Congress passed said, if you start construction by a certain date, you get your foot in the door. What the IRS says about it is helpful in clarifying what that means, but we have four different sets of transitional rules going all the way back to 1969 that give us guidance on how to get there. So I think even if they were to revoke all of the current PTC guidance, if they pulled it all out, which is virtually unprecedented, we would still be able to do deals because we know what the rules were generally. We might not do 5% safe harbor deals because the safe harbor was specific to those these particular guidance, but physical work has been a concept since 1969, so we know what that means. That being said, if people have already started spending money on these, the IRS can't go in and just retroactively change the rules of the road. They could potentially change the rules of the road going forward, but people that have spent money, there are statutory restrictions on IRS changing regulations, and rulings, notices are generally thought to be very similar to regulations in that setting. So it would be very unlikely for any kind of retroactive change. I could see on a going forward basis some degree of pressure on the IRS to maybe be a little more conservative in terms of the level of work that has to happen to put your foot in the door. The administrations largely leave the IRS to their own devices. They have policy input, but as far as writing the actual rules, they don't generally say, okay, pull it back. But I defer maybe to Jeff on that.
One more layer is that this administration is going to come in. They're going to have to fill their Treasury Department. They're going to have a lot of big things to take care of, and that's where they're going to start.
This isn't
one of the big things. I don't know why this would be the sore thumb that you whacked with a hammer right as soon as you got in there.
In addition, you know, many of the projects we're working on now are planning to you know, really get going now, and you know, if tax reform comes about over the next year, you know, as Jeff mentioned, we've got all these new appointments that have to come in. There's a lot of time before they come in and actually start focusing.
Right. And if we're doing tax reform, I mean, all hands are going to have to be on deck within the Treasury Department to stay up with this. They're going to be otherwise engaged. I'm not saying that the risk is zero. I'm saying that there's other more important things that they are necessarily going to be working on.
So maybe what it means is when we call up the IRS and we say, we've got this question, this question, this question, which we tend to like to do, maybe they say we're busy doing other stuff.
Should be good for the industry.
Might not be a bad idea. It might be a good response.
Another question for you, John. We did spend a fair amount of time talking about how a drop in the corporate tax rate might impact the availability of tax investing under the wind PTC rules. What impact might it have for the solar ITC folks?
It has less of an effect. The rate change has zero effect on the value of the credits. The credits are worth the same. The dollar of credit is worth a dollar. Doesn't matter if the rate is 10%, 20%, 100%.
Dollar of credit takes a dollar off your tax bill.
Depreciation is the same for wind and solar generally. So we have the same issues in terms of timing. I think that we will see a push for people who want to use bonus depreciation. There is some hesitancy on the part of many of the investors on using bonus. Renewables is a funny area where bonus depreciation is the ability to super accelerate your write-off of the project cost. Almost every single deal that I'm on, we opt out of it, and so this will be a change. It's actually a benefit to the investor, but the investors usually don't want to pay for it.
I see. Okay. Brian Pomper, on the trade front, a question about the likely impact on solar panels of a further duty and international border adjustability, if you would. Again, solar panels are made of silicon, which is generally silicon logs are generally grown outside of the United States. They can be assembled anywhere. Do you see a growth in panels being manufactured in the U.S.? Is that it's a likely outcome? Where do you see that going?
I mean, so I'm not an expert on the contours of the industry itself and its economics. It strikes me that for a lot of the solar panels we're talking about here, the ones made overseas, they're essentially commoditized. And I think it's going to be hard to bring a lot of that activity back to the United States. It doesn't mean that none of it will, but I'd be surprised if you really saw a whole scale of new industry, explosion of the industry here in the United States, just given the economies of scale.
Thank you. We have about 5 minutes left. I do want to go around the table one last time and ask folks, again, reading the tea leaves, in particular, the tea leaves as tax reform is or isn't going to happen and the time frame and what it's going to look like. We're going to start with the Democratic side. We'll start with Ed Pagano. Ed, you know, we talked about the potential cooperation from some Democrats in a tax reform bill. What do you're reading the tea leaves now? In 60 seconds, what do you think is likely to happen?
It's going to be the question I think that's going to have the all of Washington next year kind of debating. I think it'll be a good faith effort by the Senate Democrats. It's in their interest. I think not to be obstructionist. That doesn't work for the 10 Democrats that are up for re-election in the Trump states in 2018. I think it will be how flexible, in their view, that Republicans are in negotiations. And I really think the wild card is the Trump administration and President Trump. Is he the art of deal guy where he, declares victory and a half loaf? Or not, and then sells that to the American people. So I think that'll be the real question. So I kind of put it at 50-50. It's also hard to do, as Jeff McMillan has said. There's a reason why this hasn't been done since 1986. We all know it's a problem, as Senator News said. So that's the recognition. But to get it done, you are going to have to eliminate some deductions and other things that are popular. So I think, we shall see.
Jeff McMillan, what's your tea leaf reading?
So I think that they're going to make, like I said earlier, they're going to make a run to try to get 60 votes in the Senate. I think that makes sense. I think you're going to have some Democrats who are, for a variety of reasons that Ed and Senator Sununu have discussed, to try to do this. If we get to reconciliation, if they go to reconciliation and decide, hey, we're doing this on 51 votes, I think it's going to be hard to get Democrats on board to vote for reconciliation. It'll be more important at that, or more important, it'll be necessary for Mr. McConnell to make sure he can keep his 52 together as best as possible. I just think it'll be politically difficult for Democrats to work on reconciliation.
It'll be
not impossible, but difficult. And in the House, it'll be interesting, given Ranking Member Neal's participation, who I think has a great working relationship both with his members and with several Republicans. Maybe that opens the door for some cooperation. Obviously, it's less important in the House, but that'll be interesting to see it on reconciliation. I don't think if they go that route, it'll be difficult for Democrats in the House to vote for a reconciliation bill.
Senator Sununu, some last thoughts?
Look, the time is now. I think people on both sides of the aisle and in leadership, on the committees, and obviously in the White House know that and understand it. I think there's probably a 50 or 55% chance the tax reform gets done, but using a 10-year bill under reconciliation, maybe a 20 or 25% chance it gets done with meeting the 60-vote threshold in the Senate and a 20% chance or so that nothing happens. And I think in addition to that July 30th indication, you know, we'll know pretty certain, effectively, if it's going to get done this year. There's one other threshold that comes much sooner, and that is the completion or the action on Obamacare, which will come relatively early. There'll be a budget resolution I mentioned in early January, a vote on changes to Obamacare, tax and spending, in late January or early February. If Republicans can execute that in a reasonably clean fashion without flying apart at the seams, and Democrats, you know, allow them to have their shot, and it doesn't raise the temperature in the room too high, that increases the likelihood of doing this in a bipartisan way further down the road. If the changes to Obamacare, taxes or spending, divide the Republican caucus, deepen the differences between Democrats and Republicans, and create discontent early within the Senate chamber, that means that, one, you're going to have to go a more partisan route on tax reform, and two, it probably increases the likelihood that maybe nothing gets done. So that'll be an early indicator as to the temperature on both sides and the opportunity for tax reform through the rest of the year.
Is there any chance they flip it? They do the tax reform first?
No. No.
Good. Okay. Thank you. We are out of time. I want to, again, thank my very illustrious panel for giving their time this afternoon to answer our questions. I think they've given us great guidance. In the renewable energy space, I think it's some cautionary items, a lot of positives, some encouragement from Senator Sununu that the solar and wind guys or people need to be fully engaged as in the tax reform process. The questions we didn't get to, we will circulate later. If you have additional questions, I think you can reach any of the panelists directly by using their first initial and last name at aikengump.com, or if you like, you can certainly email any additional questions you have to me, to ezelke, E-Z-A-E-L-K-E, at aikengump.com, and I'll work with our staff to get them to the right folks on the panel. Thank you again to our audience for listening today, and have a good afternoon.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.